So I have a quick favor before we go. I'm in the middle of my doctoral research and I need some CEOs. Here's the question. Is there a point where working more hours actually indicates a worse leader? Nobody's measured it before. I'm measuring it now. So if you're a CEO or president with at least 10 people in the business and 3 direct reports, it takes just a few minutes. And your team answers a few anonymous questions. But what you get back is a report comparing how you rate yourself to how your team rates you. That gap is usually the interesting part. The link is scalingcoach.com/study. Again, scalingcoach.com/study. The link's also in the show notes. Help me out now, please. Hey, what if the thing that made you successful is the same thing that's about to break you? We know it's often the thing that's holding you back. It's in the way, right? Sunit Agarwal built Sacramento's number one real estate team, $3 billion in sales, almost all of it from a parking lot panic attack with his pregnant wife next to him. We're going to get into all that in just a minute. Hey, everybody. I'm Bill Gallagher, scaling coach and host of the Scaling Up podcast. Over 700 or nearly 700 episodes now. You'll find all those more wherever you're getting this right now. Like, subscribe, turn on your notifications, get them every week. Every Wednesday, we drop a show. And there are guests, authors, entrepreneurs. We got both today. People sharing their journey, their experience, plus some stories about our coaching clients, that kind of thing. You'll find all that and more wherever you're getting it now, but also at scalingcoach.com. At scalingcoach.com, you can also get our Q20 diagnostic, where I'll take a look at the possible growth paths for your company, the risks I think that might be involved. Do a look at your competition for you and give you some outside perspective on growth path. scalingcoach.com/Q20 is that diagnostic. You'll find that there. Go check that out if you want to. Let's get into our guest right now. Sunit Agarwal joins us from Sacramento. Sunit, welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this. Really looking forward to it.
Been CEO of Best Sacramento Homes Group, number one mega team. He's a co-founder of Reside Platform. He did over $1 billion in sales, $3 billion in career sales, 4,500 homes sold. And he's written a book now, Team Leader Secrets, mm-hmm. an Amazon bestseller that we're talking about today. In particular, Sunit, you build a team of 6 agents in just a few minutes, walking up to people at Coldwell Banker saying, I've got leads. You close them 50-50, right? Boom.
Yeah. So I was in, it was Keller Williams, but same principle.
Oh, got it.
Somebody, same thing. Told me to go buy a portal, like a real estate lead gen portal. And I think I borrowed a couple $100 and then I bought it. And now all of a sudden, you know, there are Google pay-per-click leads.
Yeah.
And I have all these leads, Bill. I'm all, well, I've never called one of these kind of leads in my life. Like, what do I say? So I made about a day worth of calls. And at that time, you know, like real estate teams were getting more in fashion. And I kind of heard about it. I had never aspired to start a team. You know, I was happy doing my thing at the time. And, but I stood up at the end of a row of cubicles, man. I'll never forget it. And I stood up, I said, hey, I got leads. I'm starting a team. Who wants to join? And everybody sitting within hearing distance raised their hand. And I was all, well, I guess we got to figure this out. And then, you know, later, welcome to leadership.
People want the leads. I need the Glengarry leads, right?
Yes.
Right? They're like, if only I had the leads. I think we all think about that at some point or another. Like, I've always been a great person as long as I had good lead flow.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And, you know, I learned then that leads are a easy carrot to dangle, but it can't be the only carrot, because then people are joining you for leads and they're leaving you for leads. You know, there's just because you got someone's name and number and a little bit of interest, it really doesn't mean that much more in many cases, especially with the big companies spending, you know, millions and millions of dollars to get those clicks inside of salespeople's CRMs, right?
Yeah. So let me just go a little bit off script here. Agarwals are famous for business.
This is true. Yes.
Yeah. What? And one of the coaches that I coached is an Agarwal who's done a bang up job of launching his coaching career. What is it that you learned in your family and in your extended family that has? Yeah.
What a good question, Bill. Well, I love talking about this. My parents, my mother and my father, were not business owners. They were very educated. My mom came here like in the 60s, right? She started being a college she was a college professor here in Northern California by the time she was 21. Right? So a lot of education, a lot of formal education. I'm the only person who doesn't have a master's in the in both lines. And my father, like many other Indian people, was an engineer, right? So, however, they both had entrepreneurship, like, driving them, right? Like, my mom, she went on to get three masters. Like, you know, that's a lot.
Don't be a slacker.
Right? She went and got three masters, and she was a professor in multiple subjects. And my father, he had definite small business aspirations, but he definitely introduced business books and self-development books. And, you know, now as an author, I am a product of the self-development books. I've read them all 100 times, right? He gave me Think and Grow Rich when I was like 12, Bill. And I remember getting that book. And I remember going to the last page looking for the secret. I was like, okay, what's the secret, right? He gave me Tony Robbins tapes at an impactful early point in my sales career, and it changed everything. So that was the impact that my father had on the entrepreneurial journey that I'm, you know, still going down. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Self-improvement, inquiry, right? Looking for answers, better way, right? Yes. Not giving up, not settling, not doing just enough, but continually reaching.
Yes, absolutely. And just mindsets, right? And seeing what's truly possible. I had, you know, like everybody, I had many challenges in my professional career that, you know, prior to getting into real estate, like I had another life that was something that I encountered really challenging times. And those fundamentals and the mindset and what's possible really kept me going.
Very many of my clients start their companies with a lot of hard work, a lot of scrappiness, a fair amount of grinding, and then it stops working at some point, right? And sometimes it even becomes a problem. In our upcoming book, I've got some stories of people who really screwed up their companies and their lives with trying to overwork instead of letting the team work. You had a whole parking lot panic attack. Talk to us about what happened to you. What was going on in your life? What happened? Tell us that story.
Yeah, it's kind of where a lot of things got into context. It was when I was still a solo agent. I hadn't started any kind of team yet. And I was grinding, right? I was just trying to make that next check. And my wife was with me in her seat, and it was February. And our daughter was born March 17th. So around the time of this recording, right? It was just her birthday. Yeah. 10 years ago, she just turned 10. And it was 10 years ago in February where I had no money. And we had to go have this baby. And I was worried about having gas to put in my car to get to the hospital when the call came. Something that many independent contractors, business people, you know, have to deal with. And at that point, and I don't know if this is in the book or not, but at that point, I did my first discovery call with a coach. And just the timing was so right. And that's what got me into, you know, opening the door to being coached formally like that in that same parking lot.
So you're in the parking lot, you're having this anxiety about having the money and all that kind of thing. And then you call the coach, or you decide to call the coach in the parking lot?
Yeah, we had a scheduled call. We had a scheduled call in like 30 minutes. So I was sitting there freaking out, and then it just right before the call. And they weren't related, right? However, they both happened just by kismet on that day.
Your wife was sitting with you in the car?
She was sitting with me, yeah.
Well.
We had a doctor's appointment or something. And, you know, like when you're a realtor, like a new one, you might have your girlfriend, spouse hang out with you all day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she was right there, pregnant. And I just knew that. I knew that something had to change, and that it was going to start with me and direction, right? And one of the first things I learned was, you know, great effective time management, which I've mastered since, and it was so impactful. It really opened the door. So yeah.
How was your wife in that interaction? How much of it did she see? Were you speaking out loud, or was she just there and you having that privately in your own head with your pulse racing and your, like, what was that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely like inside my own head, right? Like trying to figure it out. I'm a deeply introspective guy, right? And my brain, I think lots of entrepreneurs and high producers, like, we're always the brain is going, right? And, I'm sure in hindsight, I was catastrophizing a lot of stuff, which is, you know, natural in that high anxiety kind of state. But yeah, just internally, man, and the heart racing. And like, I remember even like we ended up going to the doctor. I told the doctor, like the baby doctor, the OB when my wife is pregnant, I was, you know, I think I'm having anxiety, or I think I'm having heart issues. Right. It was just anxiety from the looseness of the business and being an upcoming father. Right. And that was the motivation that just, you're going to have to do this right.
When our son was born, I had a lot of anxiety about, and there were some health events for my wife as the date approached right during the pregnancy. And so I was anxious about the health and things like that, but I wasn't thinking about like, oh, it's going to be hard to be a dad, or I'm not going to have money, or things like that. Like I thought about all that as fine. I was worried about this unknown thing, and I felt like health is fragile and random. Totally. Then we had the baby, and he was he's chill today, but at 28. Okay, good. But he was so overwhelming and so hard. And so a couple of years go by and I'm exhausted being a dad and that kind of thing. And then we are expecting our second child. And I went into a panic over that. I went into a panic, not about money. I went into panic, not about anything, just like personal space and capacity, right? It's total freak out. And I, about like, oh, my life is over now. Like me, the individual, like whatever is over. And I, the most outward visible signs is I went out and I got my pilot's license and I got my scuba certification.
Wow.
It was an early midlife thing just before my daughter was born. Cause I'm like, there are things I want for me and I better do them now. So I jammed them in there. And then my daughter was born. She was really easy. By comparison to our son at that age, at that stage, like the early birth to toddler, she was much more chill, less high demand than he is. Same. It's funny, they have up and down kinds of things, but she was very chill. And I was like, oh, it's fine. And like, but at least then I also, like, I had my pilot's license, my scuba certification. So I've taken them both scuba diving, I've taken them both flying.
That's awesome.
I don't regret that, you know. So before real estate, you had a downturn. You were doing something else and you lost. You had a collapse. You went through a transition. Talk to us. What were you doing? Take us through that whole collapse in the couple of years that built up.
Yeah, so
Starbucks.
So prior to real estate, I helped launch medical cannabis dispensaries here in Northern California, where... you know, we wrote the ordinance for Sacramento. We wrote the tax. We wrote it for Stockton. We lobbied cities. I worked with some of the big guys in your neck of the woods, hired an attorney from Oakland, right, to come and help. And we were the first legally licensed dispensary in Sacramento. And we wrote all the ordinances and the taxes in partnership with City Hall. We lobbied City Hall and they were agreeable. They're still a cannabis friendly. And now it's totally different anyways. But this was 2007, right? There wasn't any state medicinal besides just the Senate bill, SB 420. It was all medical with doctor's notes. You know, now you can call anybody and get whatever you want sent to your house. But
pretty much, right?
But back then it was a different landscape. So
and a pizza. That, you could get the weed and the pizza delivered.
And a six pack of beer, right? You could have the whole party without leaving your house. And you know, throughout that process, we were locally supported, supported by the Senate bill on the state level. But the federal government, it was during a re-election for Barack Obama. Yeah. And during that time, he instructed the U.S. attorneys to go after dispensary owner landlords in any state that had the same kind of guidelines with the medicinal, right? Yeah. So they did. And my landlord got really scared. We had two landlords and they got scared. We tried to fight it. And doing a fight resulted in a federal seizure raid where they took assets, never pressed any charges because we were a clean business. You know, they sometimes expect back then to go to someone's house and there's guns and piles of cash and all of this.
I had
bank accounts and a legitimate business. So that kind of left me wrecked because just number one, it's traumatic to have your door rammed in for cannabis, right? So that's a traumatic thing. And then to get asset seized and lose your business, like you're literally starting from zero. So that's what I had been licking my wounds from for a year prior to getting into real estate. So I had that behind me, pushing me.
So you hung out for a while with that? Like, talk about the doldrums of being in between things and what you did to get through that. Like, what were you doing in that time frame? And then and then what is it that got you into real estate? So talk about that.
So I lived with a broken up girlfriend at a house. And I'm pointing it for those of you who are watching because it's down in the same neighborhood. And I had gotten some guard dogs because we had had some break-ins and people were breaking into my house. So I got a couple of guard dogs. Right. And after everything happened with the cannabis, after I lost everything, I moved to like a farmhouse that I thought was a teardown right up the street here with my dogs. All I had was my dogs, nothing else. And like my car that almost broke down. And what did I do? Like, I didn't know what to do.
You're not married at this point, I'm guessing.
Thank goodness. I was single, right? Which probably saved my butt, was being single and not having any kids yet. You know what I did, Bill? I did some consulting work for different kinds of businesses with my marketing and, you know, business scale experience I had. And I worked out. I worked out twice a day, right? And working out at home, just gym. I learned how to live for about $2,000 a month, right? And didn't really have any direction. I didn't know what I was going to do. There was a real sense of hopelessness. And one of my good friends had just gotten into real estate a year prior, and we had done some business previously. He's all, "Hey, Sunit, I made a couple hundred grand this year. And you're sitting on your butt, like at the gym." I wasn't sitting on my butt. He's like, "And you're just working out. Like, what are you going to do with your life? You're 36 or something, right?" He said, "Let me come hang out with me. Come to Coldwell Banker and let me show you." And he did. And that's what got me back in. My first year, I was then rookie of the year, which was, I was all, well, I guess I know how to do this.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. So there you are. You're doing something, but you're not doing nothing. You're living, you're figuring out how to live. Post-smash, yeah. Post-seizure and break-in, yeah. You've got guard dogs. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm expecting to see a Glock or two somewhere.
Yeah, it was.
It's funny because I think, well, I'm not an expert in the industry at all, but it seems like that the legal cannabis industry from dispensaries to cultivation is mostly a bad business. It's so heavily taxed.
It seems like it. I'm not associated at all. Completely went away, but yeah. I still have colleagues who were my attorneys.
Yeah.
And they tell me, though, hey, I think especially in California, it might be overtaxed, which is leading to the black market having back an increase. That's what I hear. I don't follow it. I don't follow it on purpose. Like, I'm not interested anymore. Right. Yeah. Like, I have my go. I'm disengaged. Yeah.
Disengaged. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah,
that's when I was young,
you had a guy, you had your connect and yeah, the guy, exactly. Like you went there, he went to you, he like took care of you.
Yeah, totally. Same. Yeah. And the guys would tend to rotate. You'd lose track of someone and find a new one through one of your buddies. And
well, they weren't the course. Most, they weren't the most stable people. Yeah. So then, then you're solo, you're making some money, you're a solo real estate agent, and then you build a team. Talk about why you build a team, what led you to, you mentioned a little bit getting some leads and that kind of thing. Talk to us about solo to team lead and why you did that and what you learned.
Yeah, so, you know, after that panic attack with the discovery call with that coaching company, they... Mm-hmm. encouraged me to start a team. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't enough yet. Their encouragement, it wasn't enough. I was content.
Uh-huh.
However, then my daughter was born, like I said, about 10 years ago. And within months, I realized that I couldn't work. I didn't think I could work at the same clip that I was. As a traditional real estate agent, showing houses, evenings, weekends, all this, I couldn't do that and spend as much time with my newborn baby as I wanted to, right? I needed leverage, and I needed scale. So the team, with the encouragement from the coach I had at the time, and just reality, once again, timing, right? Kismet, like it just made sense.
That was your driver. So you start building the team. Talk to us about what happens. You said you found people who wanted to be on the, like, you know, people said yes, but then what? Like, how did that go? What did, like, how did that develop? Right.
Take yeah. So like, so people joined and I was being coached, but, you know, I learned about, well, you know, my previous business ownership experience, Bill, was owning a dispensary and having people work at the counter and work in the back and all of this, right? Now I'm leading independent contractors in a more professional field, at least at the time. Outward, completely public-facing field. And I learned the difference about personalities and sales. I learned about what motivates versus inspires salespeople. I realized how you can help people through accountability, right? And just a lot of people lessons. I understood really quickly that the people move the money, right? Like in a sales business, There's skill acquisition, absolutely, but the accountability has to be driving, and people need to be inspired. And I can't motivate anybody. So me understanding those things about people early on, through books and coaching and practical experience. It's really allowed me to like focus on the things that move the money, the people. We talked about recruiting, right? Like many leaders of a sales organization, the leaders will say, well, my salespeople should want to make more money every year because I want to make more money every year, right? Mm-hmm. That's like the natural thing to fall into. But if everybody was so focused on growth, then being a leader wouldn't be such an opportunity, right? People get mm-hmm. content, and there's mm-hmm. nothing that I'm going to tell anybody that's going to inspire them to want to make more money. That's mm-hmm. that's going to motivate them to make more money. They either want it or they don't. Now, I can inspire somebody. Well, how can I inspire somebody? Well, from leading from the front, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, so just lots of lessons about people. I think that's where the opportunity is, understanding people.
Have you had particular, are there books or ideas that have, or trainers or people that have stood out for you particularly in this realm?
For like
leading others, inspiring, elevating, motivating.
I like Patrick Lencioni for sure.
Uh-huh.
Right. I like, what's that?
He's an East Bay guy. He's
oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that. And I think like, you know, any of the fundamental books, Think and Grow Rich, right? I love The Compound Effect. I love Zig Ziglar stuff, right? Like Tony Robbins.
Yeah,
Zig is my stuff, dude. Like I remember driving around with my dad. Listening to Zig.
Do it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, but I mean, it's really the fundamentals,
yeah.
Right? Like Marcus Aurelius, right? If you want to go back, like.
Yeah.
There's it's the fundamentals. Jim Rohn on leadership is great, right? So
yeah, those are classics. Well, you know, it's funny. I had a sales manager once, and he taught me some funny lessons that I still, and it's the funnier ones that stick with me. One of them was on the motivation. He's like, you want them to produce more? Have them buy a nicer car, buy a house, get their spouse pregnant. Get a fancier, like higher lifestyle partner, like all the things that create pressure for more money. It's like they make a little money, they're good, they get a car they like, and then
yes,
like, step up lifestyle.
yes. I mean, here's the thing. This is the reality of the world. Is every day people with poor habits leading to poor health go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Smoke. Drug abuse, smoke, drugs, excessive alcohol, excessive weight. Yep. Every single day, thousands of these people go to the doctor.
Yeah.
And the doctor says, if you do not change your habit, you will die premature.
Yeah.
Yet the behavior of most people doesn't change. In fact, it only changes about 20% of the time. If you want to talk about the Pareto principle.
Well, because the immediate pleasure of my smoking, drinking, whatever I'm doing.
Yes.
Outweighs the delayed pain of that suffering of, you know.
So motivation. Yes. Motivation to live longer is not enough for 80% of the people to change their habits. What the hell am I going to tell somebody, Bill, if that's the truth? They don't even care about living longer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I want to get them to make extra calls. Are you out of your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I can do is take somebody down a path of discovery where they can figure out on their own what they need to do the thing that they want, not the thing that I want them to do, but what they want. And then with accountability, help them get there. Right. That's like the only thing I've seen that works.
Well, I think you're speaking to the same kind of thing, but so he was just like, just get interested in their life and then encourage them to lead a bigger, fuller life. Right. So
totally. Yeah.
I'd talk with him about whatever, and I'd be like, okay, well, that's really great. And well, I'm sure you are hoping for a better apartment someday, or a house of your own, or that kind of thing. So you just, like, you get interested and curious and related to them as human beings. Then you'd plant a little seed about something, you know, that was the step up or that kind of, that's a pretty cool car. You'll probably like that for the next few months. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think some of that. Funny. And then, he had another one was, if you have to talk to them about personal hygiene, it's a lost cause. Like, if they don't know to take a shower, you should just get rid of them.
That's funny. That is funny. That is funny. I've never heard that one, but I'm going to keep it.
Well, you know, in those days I was running a sales team for a company, and I had, 10 salespeople, not a big sales team, you know?
Sure.
And I was probably 24, something like that. So I'm 24, wow. I'm running a sales team, right? Young team. And most of the people working for, not all of them, but a few of the people working for me are older than me. So he's like trying to talk to me, and I want to explain to them like how to pitch or whatever. He's like, no, we got to deal with the motivation and the personal habits and the step up, that kind of thing. Years later, I learned something that I believe is a Zig Ziglar thing. And I found it really helpful for me and for some of my clients, but not as many as I would like. And maybe you've encountered this one too. It's the be, do, have.
Okay.
The be, do, have. And the be, do, have says, a lot of people have it backwards. They think that when they have $1 million or 100 million or a billion or whatever it is, then they will finally do things and they'll be a certain way. Yes. And Zig Ziglar is like, you got to flip it around. You got to imagine yourself being a certain way, and then you'll do certain things, and then you'll have different results. And I have applied it in many areas of my life, but one of them that stood out when I learned it probably, well, more than 10 years earlier, but I didn't really apply it yet until I found myself with two kids and struggling businesses and some real fitness issues, right? I'm like fat, and I'm worried about my health, and I got cholesterol issues, and I'm on the couch and I can't, like, whatever. And so I do the exercise at the direction of my coach at the time. And I'm like, well, I have about 40 pounds too many, right? I have bad fitness. I have a gym. I have a personal trainer. I have a fancy gym membership and includes things like massage and a private locker and laundry service. Like, I had the executive, I had the upscale thing. And yet I don't go. Like, I call in. So what am I doing? I have the personal trainer. I have the gym membership. I have these things. I also have the weight line, the waistline, and the extra pounds, that kind of thing. Sure. And I am, the doing or not doing is, I'm calling my trainer like a little bit before and saying, hey, I got a thing, I can't get there. And so I'm paying him not to work out. Like, I'll pay your fee anyway, but I won't be there. And then I go in my car and I drive through McDonald's or KFC and I get the supersized meal. And then I take it back to my desk and I keep working through things. So I have stress and now I'm eating shit and I'm not working out. And so, I'm worried, right, about my health. So I'm being defeated. And I'm being a loser. Right. And I am, and really, if I'm honest, my sort of unconscious view that appeared to me in a few minutes is, well, look, I don't have the DNA that those super fit people do, the great athletic.
Yeah, the story. You're telling yourself a old story.
And so really my goal here is just to live long enough to see my kids grow. And that was kind of heartbreaking, right? Because it was so sad. Yeah. It's so defeatist, right? That is as much, like, eventually I'm going to have a heart attack. So I just want to delay it long enough and be less pathetic, right? And let's not even get into the impacts of my relationship, my self-esteem. Totally. And all that kind of thing,
absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
So what would I do if I had the DNA? What if I had the DNA? What if I had the fitness? What if I had a different waistline, a different scale reading, right? All of that kind of thing. Well, I would do really cool things. I would do extraordinary things. If I was like that, I'd be out there on the Marina Green, like living large. Like I'd be active and I'd be alive. I'd be inspired. I'd be out there like in the sunshine and living my best life with the view of the Golden Gate Bridge. And then I realized, oh, with whatever DNA I have, I could be active, alive, and inspired.
Yes, good.
With whatever I got, I could do that. What would I do if I had that? And then I thought, I'd do something amazing. I don't know what it is yet. But the next day, I'm thinking about that. And the next day, I heard this woman talking about running her first marathon. And she's talking about running it, and she's training now, and she's passed like a 13-mile distance, so maybe she would run 18 by that point or so. So she's getting really close to her first marathon. And I look at her, and I think privately, well, she's fatter than me. And she looks less like athletic than me, but she's running a flipping marathon, and that sounds a little painful to me. So I'm like, I need to do something like that. It sounded so outrageous. Now it sounds, lots of people run marathons. But at the time, as a guy who weighed more and couldn't get off the couch, and I was like, that's so amazing. And I'm like, oh, I should do something like outrageous, not just go to the gym a little bit more, but I should do something outrageous, but I don't want to run a marathon because it sounds a little painful. So I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to run a triathlon. And I decided in that moment, and then I told people in the next moment, I think I'm going to run a triathlon, except I didn't know what that was. It just, I knew it wasn't a marathon. It was like a distance event of some kind. Multiple things. It sounded a little more. I knew there was a bike involved, you know, like, it sounded less painful. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to run a triathlon. I told people, and then I looked up, you know, Googled what's a triathlon and what's involved and how do I do that? And then I realized, oh, I gave up on swimming in the seventh grade because I was so pathetic and I didn't know how to swim like properly, like for speed and that kind of thing. So I'm like, God, I said now to people that I'm going to run a triathlon and I'm active, alive, and inspired. So I commit to running a triathlon. I register in a triathlon. I find a triathlon coach and a swim coach. And I start working out every day and I quit my gym membership.
Wow.
But I went on to working about 13 hours a week for 11 years. And I did 45 triathlons and a few marathons.
45? Bill, that's a lot.
And I lost those pounds and I look pretty good today. I'm 61 years old now and I look better than I did when I started that journey. You know, like
45 triathlons. Good for 45 you, man.
Of them, right? That's that be do have kind of thing, right? So that's an old Zig Ziglar thing.
That's a powerful story.
I find that's really useful. Like if you had those things, how would you be then? And what would you do with that? Right. And we could actually flip that around and start looking at where the like active, alive, and inspired was the quality that I most admire beyond having the DNA, beyond having the fitness, right? And that actually shifted my view of the present. Then I needed to commit to something and work on it. And that just was like, I said, I'm going to do it. I declared it publicly. That creates accountability, right? Tell a lot of people, now you have some natural accountability.
Yes, yes. That's such a great story, man.
Commit,
thanks plan, for sharing that,
right?
With me. Yeah. Yes.
There's like 45 finisher medals and stuff over there in the corner of the office and that kind of thing, right? I never had any chance of being in the top 10. I was never good at it.
It's about completing it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just about doing it and about setting my own personal goals and the next one and the next one and the next one.
Did you ever do any there in the bay or what?
Oh, yeah. The one I probably did the most, about seven times I did this Escape from Alcatraz triathlon.
That's what I was going to ask. Alcatraz,
and you bike all around the city and you run along the beach and up and down the sand ladder. And it's a pretty grueling non-standard event, but it's stunningly beautiful, right? And then you look at it and you're like, I'm a master of all that. I can swim in.
Yes. I was in the city last weekend on St. Patrick's Day, and it was beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I went out to go windsurfing on St. Patrick's Day. And it.
Oh, yeah. We went to a concert at the Warfield. That was a good time. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've covered a lot of interesting things here. Let's tackle one more maybe two more little things as we wrap up. But let's talk about recruiting and building so bringing the people in and then the culture that keeps them there.
Yeah. So bringing people in, if you want to grow your business, you must have more people work for you. Right. So you do sales business, right? Not, not if you own a store or a restaurant, don't hire unnecessarily, right? Or some kind of,
but
we hire 1099 contractors. There is still cost. People. Yes. There is still cost. Need.
Yeah.
So recruiting should be seen as one of the major levers of growth, right? And you must it's lead gen. Like need to generate leads, you need to market. It's a less conventional kind of marketing funnel compared to buying and selling houses, right? Because there's licensing that's involved. You must be talking to people if you want to recruit licensed agents. So you need to make calls. You need to be good at organic and paid marketing. You know how to send the emails, you know, stuff that we both tell people to do. And then you have to have a frictionless process to get people in, and you have to get them productive in a 1099 environment as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like every day that people don't get the opportunity to do business is one day they're closer to walking out the door, right? Mm-hmm. So culture, you know, like there's a quote that I learned from somebody, like, is eagles don't want to hang around turkeys.
Yeah, it's probably on one of those accessories posters or something.
Yeah, right. That one's like at the back of the rack, right? But eagles don't want to hang around with turkeys. When you're in a 1099 type of environment with culture, the culture is dictated by the people who are on the W-2 payments because they actually come in every day because they have to, right? So they're the holders of the culture. So they should be collaborative and giving and be seen as a steward to helping the salespeople get more of what needs to happen. Yeah.
Certain people being more important to the culture. Any specific elements of culture that you use or like to use?
I mean,
moments in time, structures.
Culture is such like a buzzword, or at least it was, especially prior to COVID. I feel like people quit talking about culture when more people started working from home. But at the same time, like a great culture happens when a lot of people are working around each other. Post-COVID, California, me and you are both working from home, right? I have a beautiful office. I haven't been there in 3 weeks. I don't know about you. But as the employees or the stewards, because they have to show up, how do you have culture around people who don't have to be anywhere? And it's funny because it comes back into spending time together. If you want to increase the culture in your sales organization, do an activity offsite. I don't care if you go like axe throwing or get a happy hour with some potato skins and mini pizzas at the local cafe, right? At the local bar. And, you know, let the relationships build in this post-COVID type of environment to really see what you can do with culture.
Yeah, it's really valuable. I think about like it's those offsite activities, but it's also the activities in your office, the way you celebrate birthdays, the way you greet people in the morning, the way you run the meetings, the decorations you throw up, the things you celebrate, the awards you give out, like all of that stuff contributes to your culture, right?
Well, like for us, like we use Slack free version still religiously. I'm very proud of using the free version of Slack for 7 years, Bill. maybe it's somebody who works there listens to this, I'll get an upgrade email. But you know, like, what are you doing in the group messaging as people get further and further geographically away from each other inside an independent contractor type of environment, right?
Yeah. Yeah, one of our teams did that really well. They would call out their quarterly themes or rally cries all the time. And one quarter, it was about the chief rainmaker for the company. So they would do hashtag KKS.
Yeah.
Hashtag, every time they did something, it'd be hashtag KKS. And that would tie into something they were talking about. They just did something that helped that in some way. Hashtag KKS. Keep Kevin selling.
Yes. Love it. Exactly. That is people so like, great.
How do you get this quarterly theme is all just about Kevin? No, it's about everybody. Kevin's the one doing the selling, but we all have to make sure Kevin keeps selling. What are the things that we do that help him sell or get in the way of him selling? Let's focus on that. That's what we do to keep him, like, you know, pulling together, you know?
Love it. Yes, absolutely. Let's keep the salespeople selling. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, we've talked about a lot of great things today. TeamLeaderSecrets.com is the book. Go check out, go buy a copy. Go check it out, TeamLeaderSecrets.com.
Thanks.
Sunit Agarwal, thank you so much for joining us from sunny, warm. It's probably hot as hell there today in Sacramento.
It's 90. Yes, it's 90. Yeah. Can you believe it?
Can you believe it's winter, right?
Yes, it's winter.
Spring doesn't start for a week. Still winter.
Yes.
Terrible ski season.
That's what I heard. Yes.
Terrible ski season. But anyway, we live in interesting. By the time this airs, we'll be deep into spring. But thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to Wanda and Anna for producing our show and getting it out every week. Thanks to my friend and mentor, Vern Harnish, who created the whole scaling up framework that's the heart of our work. And if you want more from us, our workshop, that Q20 assessment, or any of that, scalingcoach.com is a place to go. Or if you want to send a referral my way. So all that and more, scalingcoach.com. Thanks again, everyone, for watching, for listening. Until next time, keep scaling. Thanks for listening today. One last thing. If anything in this episode hit home, my book digs into it further. Busy is broken. Do less, scale more. It's all about how to stop drowning in work and build a business and a team that scales without you. Available right now with content samples at busyisbroken.com. Go grab it. Be less busy.